Tonight's shiur is dedicated to Nishmas Avram Yitzchak Ben Yaakov. Parashas Beshalach is again continuing a storyline that began at the end of Parashas Boy, where we're on our way out of Mitzrayim. It's very exciting. You know, we're supposed to relive the entire experience. It's not only on Pesach. It's supposed to be when we read the Parashas. It's over a story from Reb Chatzko Levenstein, that someone wanted to see how Reb Chatzko Levenstein does Shtayim Mikavecha Targum. There's always one nudnik in every yeshiva who wants to harass the Rebbe to see how he does this and how he does that. So there was one Talmud who wanted to see how the Rebbe did Shtayim Mikavecha Targum. So he went into his house on Parshas Boy of Eira, one of those two Parshas, and he hides in the closet and he wants to see how's his Rebbe going to do Shtayim Mikavecha Targum. And he sits down to the table of Chatzko Levenstein, then Panovich and Mashkiach. And he starts talking to himself. He says, "Oh, I can't believe it. The blood's going to come, and they're going to drink blood, and the frogs are going to be jumping on their head." And he came out, and he jumps out. He scares his Rebbe probably half to death. And he says to him, "Rebbe, I got to ask you, like, you know, you're not 5 years old anymore." He said, "When you read these parashas, you're supposed to relive it. You're supposed to relive the Machkas. You're supposed to live Yitzis Mitzrayim. You're supposed to relive Kriyas Yamsuf. You're supposed to really relive the storyline. It's not just, you know, remember it. We're reliving it. Can you imagine what it was like to go through Kriyas Yamsuf? I was just thinking this on my way over here. Kriyas Yamsuf is a big deal. Probably the highlight of Parashas Beshalach is Kriyas Yamsuf. It was a serious, serious event. You know, these are major events that often we learn them when we're young, so we can only perceive it as that age. And as we mature, our imagination matures, as does our thinking process, and we have to often remind ourselves these are major, major events. So while Klal Yisrael is in the middle of leaving Mitzrayim, or as Klal Yisrael does leave Mitzrayim, in this week's Parasha we hit what I call bumps along the road, which is really a foreshadowing for life. But as Klal Yisrael is developing as a nation, they're going to have some bumps. And this week's parasha is going to be some major bumps along the way. Along with the bumps are obviously the highlights and the ups of life. But again, there's some lower parts for Klal Yisrael as well. One of the main things that are discussed in this week's parasha, obviously, is Kriyas Yamsuf. That's one of the main themes of this week's parasha and a very important theme that we do need to discuss. But there's also some other very important lessons along the way, such as Mara, when Klal Yisrael starts to complain, which they do well, and for many parashas, there's something to that as well. And they get some mitzvahs in this week's parasha, which is obviously very important as well. And of course, the mon, a very, very central theme of this week's parasha. You can check everyone's email box. Yesterday, you must have got 800,000 emails reminding everyone that you have to read Parashas Haman, as if it's somewhere in the Yud Gimel Ikrim of Halacha. You have to read Parashas Haman on Tuesday. They say, "Oh, from the Satmar Rebbe." The Satmar Rebbe said, "You only say Parashas Haman until 9 o'clock in the morning. And then after 9 o'clock, go to work." That's what you do. That's the biggest school. It's go to work, have a job, and make money. That's the best school in the world, right? But maybe we'll talk about that as well if we have a little more time this evening. And then we get to the end of the parsha. The end of the parsha is a very important theme, and that's Amalek. Our interactions, our war, our battle with Amalek that takes place at the end of the parsha, and the timing of Amalek is very significant as well. To after all of the amazing miracles and things that we've all took place, then Amalek comes and decides to attack. That's a little bit of a background of the many things we probably won't have time to talk about in this week's parasha, but those are some of the highlights in the parasha. But the first line, the first opening line of the pasuk, "Vayihi b'shalach paroi esam," it was when Paroi sent the Jewish people out. So the Aruch Haim HaKadosh points at two very, very important observations in the first few words of the pasuk. "Vayihi," we mentioned this many times, the Gemara tells us in Megillah, "Vayihi" is always a lashon tsar, depressing, sad. If I was writing the Torah, I wouldn't think this is pretty good. We're on our way out. Why? Asks the Aruch Haim HaKadosh, why is it Vayihi Loshen Tsar? Second question asked the Aruch Haim HaKadosh, "Bishalach Paroi," when Paroi sent us out? If I remember correctly, Hashem sent us out. Paroi was actually not involved in the equation. So asks the Aruch Haim HaKadosh two questions. Why is it Vayihi Bishalach? Why is it Vayihi Loshen Tsar? What's depressing about this storyline? And secondly, why is it Bishalach Paroi? Paroi didn't send us out. So the Aruch Haim HaKadosh has a very interesting pshat. He actually has two pshat. He explains that if it would have went the way it was supposed to, things would have been very different. Says the Aruch Haim HaKadosh, the problem is that Paroi thinks that it was really him. He thinks he was convinced and broken down to the point where he agreed to let us out. So Paroi thinks it was him. Now that Paroi thinks he was the one who decided to free us, Paroi now thinks he can retract that opinion. Therefore, says the Aruch Haim HaKadosh, it's because Paroi thinks he was the one who did it, he thinks he actually has an opinion in the matter. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu did it, and Paroi's hands were tied, so what's Paroi going to come back? You weren't in control the first time. But since Paroi thinks he was the one who did it, so Paroi says, I changed my mind. I want to go back. Therefore, says the Aruch Haim HaKadosh, that's why we have problems. We have problems now that Tsar is because Paroi thinks he was the one who freed us. Which is a very important lesson that Pari, till the end, now hopefully we'll get to this a little later this evening, Pari convinced himself that he was right and in control the entire time. With all the machlokes and with everything, and maybe even after Kriyas Yamsuf as well, Pari stuck to his guns, as crazy as they may sound, that he is still running the show. Pari held himself to be a god, equal if not greater than HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he was not willing to convince himself, perhaps those around him as well, that he lost this battle. He fought this battle till the end, and maybe even after that. So that's the first pshat the Arachayim HaKadosh explains. The Medrash tells us that the reason why it's a Lashon Tsar is because the Mitzriim were wiped out. The Makkos killed them literally, figuratively as well. And therefore they were forced to free us. And because they were forced to free us, that's why it's Lashon Tsar. Doesn't really answer the question. But the Arachayim HaKadosh has a second pshat. And he points out whenever you find in the Torah the word it's always a reference not to the highest, most reputable members of society, but rather to the Erev Rav. The the nation, is not B'nai Yisrael. If you look in the parasha, the Torah says, "Vahi b'shalach paray esa the people. The people is not a dearing, loving relationship. It's the Erev Rav. Who are the Erev Rav? They make up a large portion of us, at least in the beginning, but they were people that weren't born and raised Jewish. They joined the fold for many reasons, because they saw the miracles, they saw Mitzrayim were losing, and I would imagine if you were a Mitzri and you'd watch it, I would probably switch teams also. Go for the winning team. Who wants to be part of the losing team? Unless you're a Met fan, then you don't want to be part of a team that always loses. But other than that, you want to be on the winning side of things. So they joined. They didn't necessarily have the right reason. Says the Arachayim HaKadosh. That was the problem over here. Vahi b'shalach paroi. Pari sent us the Erev Rav. We don't want the Erev Rav. We knew there were going to be trouble, and they were, and they continue to be the trouble throughout these parshas. So Pari sent us. Pari knew this. Pari is smart. He said, "Hey, Erev Rav, I want you to go with the Jewish people." That's the tsar. We didn't need this group. Kosh Baruch Hu, the Lashon of Arachayim HaKadosh is interesting. He says we wanted authentic, real. That's what Kosh Baruch Hu wanted and desired. He didn't want these people. He didn't want this group. And therefore that created the feeling of tzad, that Kosh Baruch Hu didn't really want this group to be part of Am Yisrael. We wanted authentic. Those who want to be part of Klai Yisrael, those born into Klai Yisrael, not necessarily the Mitzri. What does the Pasuk tell us? We took, this is obviously before we have ways, but we took a very funny path to get to our destination. And there was a cheshbon for it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, "Ki amar likim pen yinochem ha'am b'sam l'chama v'shavu Mitzrayim." HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as we see in this week's parasha, there's this fear of Klai Yisrael desiring to return to Mitzrayim. Now, if you think about it, it's an interesting idea. Why would you want to go back to a place where people oppress you? You ever speak to Holocaust survivors? Very often they'll say, "I have no interest in going back to that country. I don't even want to go back near the area. I was oppressed. I don't want to even go near it." Yet we keep on finding that the Klai Yisrael themselves keep on saying, "Let's go back to Mitzrayim." What are you going back to? A land that didn't want you? That you worked for 200 and something years? But it's true. We find it. And that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu was worried. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, "Pen yirasam b'chama v'shav Mitzrayim." You get scared away, you're going right back. Because as humans, we know what we know. We're familiar and we go back to it. You know, people often make decisions based on what they're used to. Although it's not better, but it's just what they're used to. This is what I know. I know the streets here. I know the merchants. I know the area. Although it's not a best place. And again, there were many Jews who did go back to Europe after the war. And some of them built and some of them left. And some of them Nebuchadnezzar even killed. Many of their former neighbors killed them when they came back. Polish were known for this, killing Jews after they came back after the Holocaust. So it's an interesting relationship that people have with their former country that oppressed them, but yet we see that there was this nesoyin, this desire to want to go back. And the Pasuk tells us, "Vayasev elikim esa'om derech hamidbar." Kadosh Baruch Hu took the Jewish people in a somewhat of a roundabout way, derech hamidbar yamsuf. So there's a famous medrash that everyone talks about when you get closer to Pesach, that we learn from this medrash that Kadosh Baruch Hu had the people do haseba. The Jewish people at the time of Mitzrayim, they leaned. And therefore we lean the night of the Seder. This is one of the sources, although the idea of Haseba at the Seder is assumed to be the Rabbanon, one of the sources of why we do Haseba comes from this Medrash. The Medrash says, "Vayasev, Lashon Haseba." Because Baruch Hu had the Jewish people sometime during Yitzhak Mitzrayim lean to do an active procedure of leaning, and that's why we today have this idea of leaning. The reason why it's important to note this is because it makes it now that the reason why we lean at the Seder is to remind ourselves of what the Jews did when they left Mitzrayim. It's to commemorate something they did. Another one of those many things that we do, Zecher, the Yitzhak Mitzrayim, to commemorate what the Jewish people did at that time in history.
Are women
Yes, this is where, I was just trying to not get into it, but this is where everyone talks about the famous Rav Yah. I heard this cheshma for Rav Shech, that's a very nice cheshma. The Rav Yo writes that bizman hazeh women don't lean. Why? Says the Rav Yo, because today no one should lean. The Rav Yo writes no one should lean today. Because it's very uncomfortable to lean, right? How many people don't enjoy that part of the Seder because they're leaning? So the Rav Yo says no one should lean. So the Ramah says in Shulchan Aruch, oh, for that reason women don't lean. So the question is, so why do men lean? We're the same. So the way he explained it was that there's something called afein hoyibay senes. There's certain mitzvahs that women are obligated because they took place in the experience. That's why the chayim dal kaisis, Megillah, their Hanukkah, things like that. So he wants to know, so women should have to be chayim and haseba as well because they were part in haseba. So therefore he wanted to say that that's the pshat. The reason why we lean today is because the Jewish people leaned back then. But today the leaning is only to commemorate that leaning. And since it's merely a commemoration, women are not obligated in commemoration. They're only obligated in procedures that clearly show freedom. And this doesn't show it, so therefore they're not obligated. Men are obligated to commemorate, women are not obligated to commemorate. That's how they explain how women use the Rav Yo. It's worth mentioning. Yeah. The Ramah writes, I'm saying the Ramah writes that the Gemara says, Chashuv women are supposed to lean. So the Ramah says, all our women are Chashuv. I have a fight with my wife every year. I always tell her she should lean. One of the definitions of chashuv means you have your own job and you have your own money. My wife has got both of that and more than me. So I told her she should always lean. She doesn't like to. In the Stiplus family, they used to lean. And Kivega's second wife was the daughter of the Chassam Sofer. So they always used to lean because her father was a Chassam Sofer. Her father was a Kivega. How can you not lean? The Sfaradish women don't lean, but the Ashkenazi women, they all lean. They all lean. They should lean. I think if a woman has her own status in society, she has a reputable position, she has her own title, she's her own person, I think she should lean. However, it's worth mentioning, although it's not a Pesach share, even if women don't lean, Rav Asher Weiss writes this, but they still shouldn't eat on the go. They still should sit down like a mensch. Very often, if you're a mother running a Seder, you're lucky if you can grab a cup of dal kaisis and some matzah. That's not correct. You should sit down like a mensch. You still have to eat like a mensch. You maybe don't have to do haseba, but you still have to eat derech eris. If you're eating on the go with three kids on your lap while you're trying to make the salad, that's not right. That's not derech eris. That's what he writes, halach lemaisa, in Minchas Asher. What happens at the end of this pasuk? It says the pasuk, v'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael meres Mitzrayim. V'chamushim came up of the Jewish people from Eretz Mitzrayim. What is chamushim? Many pshatim. Rashi quotes a pshat, ein chamushim ela mizuyonim. Klai Yisrael came out with weapons. Was Jewish weapons. Says the pasuk, Klai Yisrael came out with weapons. Everyone asks the kasha, one second, if Klai Yisrael had weapons, so this whole story of Mitzrayim should have went down very differently. They had weapons in Mitzrayim, and they had weapons at Kriyas Yam Sof. Two questions. Why don't we just revolt in Mitzrayim? And secondly, what's this big dilemma? What do we get to Kriyas Yam Sof? Turn around and shoot them. Why is it so complicated? So the Maram Shik writes that he found a manuscript from his Rebbe, the Chassam Sofer, where the Chassam Sofer wrote that pshat is that the Jews couldn't use the weapons on the Mitzrayim. They couldn't come to terms to kill a Mitzri. Why? Because we know you have to treat a Mitzri with respect. It says in the Torah, like society of Mitzri. You have to treat a Mitzri differently than you treat an Amalek. That's the end of this week's parasha. A Mitzri can even marry into Klal Yisrael. There's a certain level, and it's a funny relationship that we have with the Mitzrayim, even today, that we have to have a certain level of Akaras HaTov. They did take us into their country. They did hurt us, yes. Says the Chassam Sofer, for this reason, Klal Yisrael couldn't consciously turn their guns on their native Mitzrayim, although the Mitzrayim were horrible people. They couldn't consciously turn their guns. Other Rishonim say they didn't know what to do with a gun. They don't know what to do. They weren't trained. What do they know about guns? I always use this as an analogy as we're running it towards the end of the story of Mitzrayim. I have to use all my analogies to the Holocaust. This was always the big discussion, why did the Jews revolt? And all we know they did, and the Warsaw Ghetto revolt. We've spoken many times about it from a halachic standpoint and a hashkafic standpoint. It's always worth noting that the ghetto lasted, their revolt lasted longer than the entire Polish government. The Germans took over Poland quicker than they were able to take over the ghetto. That's something to think about. But nonetheless, Jews by derech klal don't revolt. That's because they're not so understanding of some of the details of what they needed to do, at least many of the Jews at that time. And it's more than that. It's a mentality. When you view someone as your oppressor for so many years, and there in Mitzrayim was even longer than Nazi Germany, you're not thinking in terms of throwing the government, you're just thinking of survival day to day. Most people weren't really thinking about how we're going to be able to overthrow them and do all this. They were just thinking that if I wake up in the morning, I'm happy that I'm still alive. It's a whole different mindset, and perhaps that's a similar idea we find there as well. But the second pshat in Rashi is even more interesting, perhaps. The second pshat in Rashi is that the Lashon Chamushim means only one-fifth of the Jews left Mitzrayim, which means four-fifths of the Jews died. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky writes it's about 2 million people. That's a Holocaust. 2 million Jews didn't leave Mitzrayim. about 80% of the people did not survive, which is why the heir of Rav might have made up a large number of the 600,000, might have been heir of Rav, because we lost many of our own. And therefore, says the Torah, only a small amount of Jews actually left. So the question that the Mefarshim ask is, Schwab points this out, he says, why did they die during Choshech? So no one should notice. Ask Reb Schwab, you don't think right after Choshech, Mitzrayim wondered, hey, there's a lot less Jewish people around? We're talking about four-fifths of the people died. So Reb Steinman asks, who put all these Levayas together? To about four-fifths? That's a lot of people. That's a lot of the Levayas when you're about to leave Mitzrayim. But says Reb Schwab, how could it be that Mitzrayim didn't notice? That's a large amount of the population that's missing. What was the secret over here? They couldn't tell? So Reb Schwab says something which is obviously connected to the Holocaust as well. He says, when we talk about four-fifths, we don't necessarily mean numbers-wise, we mean long-term. Because if these people didn't live, so their future generations didn't live as well. So although you're right, they didn't die right now, percentage-wise, 80% of the community didn't leave. But long-term, because this generation died out, there was no future generations, we always look towards the future. Which is often when we talk about the Holocaust, we say, oh, 6 million. But it's much more than 6 million. It's 6 million didn't produce the next generation, next generation, next generation. So we really lost much larger than the numbers present. Says Reb Schwab here also, those numbers are really reflective of the future, not merely reflecting what happened at the time. Some of Farshim point out, if you think about it, 4/5 of the people died, you have a lot of Yisayimim on your hands. You have a lot of widows. You have a lot of children. Who took care of all these kids? Who took care of all these kids? You have to remember, you're leaving Mitzrayim. You have your bag and your stick, and you're really preoccupied with yourself. Can you imagine who took care of all these children? So perhaps the reason why this happened was that Klal Yisrael needed to fix something. Moshe Rabbeinu told us in Parashat Shmos, Ochei noida hadover. I now know why this is all happening, because you guys are not getting along together. There's Lashon Hara. There's a breach in Achdus. When did we ever fix that breach? So perhaps this is the time to fix it. When Klal Yisrael was at a point where many families were lost, there were kids just wandering alone. Who's going to help them get out of Mitzrayim? Who's going to guide them? Who's going to help them? They lost their parents in the middle of Choshech. So maybe that was like the tikkun, that was the kapara for the breach in unity that happened in Sefer, in Parashat Shmos, is now going to be in Parashat Mishalach. The 4/5 died, and someone's going to help out. Someone's got to pitch in. And Klal Yisrael gathered together as one to take care of those who lost family members and those that were alone. And maybe that's the tikkun. That's probably why it says Vayihi, Lashon Tsar. It's very depressing. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to discuss that 4/5 of his nation didn't survive. That's very depressing. Lashon Tsar, Vayihi, Lashon Tsar. Because 4/5 of Klal Yisrael did not survive and did not come out to see Yetzias Mitzrayim. What does the pasuk tell us? Vayikach Moishes Atzmas Yosef Imoi. Moshe Rabbeinu took the bones of Yosef Imoy with him. What does it mean with him? So I saw a beautiful idea that the only thing we take with us, Imoy means for long term, for Nitzchis. What do we take with us forever? It's mitzvahs. Can't take anything else with you, right? You can't take the money, can't take cars, nothing else goes with you. Person's buried by himself, empty. So therefore, Dr. Torah, Vayikach Moishes Atzmas Yosef, mitzvah, spirituality, imoy, that goes with you forever. That's the only thing you can hold on for the rest of your life and past that is nitzchias, is mitzvahs. Everything else is merely a fleeting pleasure. It's not going to take with you to the world that lasts forever. But the Gemara in Saita tells us something special about this pasuk. Pasuk tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu is called an Ish Chacham Lev. Pasuk in Mishle, it says Ish Chacham Lev. He's a man of wisdom in his heart. This is referring to Moshe Rabbeinu. Why? Because everyone else was so busy when they left Mitzrayim figuring out how to get the money. And Moshe was focused on getting Atzmas Yosef. He was focused on getting the bones of Yosef. So the question that many Mefarshim ask is, but that was also a mitzvah. Gathering the booty was a mitzvah. Hashem commanded them, I want you to leave Mitzrayim with money. So why was it a tain on Klal Yisrael? So the truth is the Biskarov writes, it's not so. Biskarov said that gathering the money from each other before we left was not a mitzvah. It was a rishos. It was permission. It was not a mitzvah. It was never given as a tziva, as a commandment. But the bones of Yosef, that was a commandment. So Reb Schwab answers that in life, you have to ask yourself, when presented with a dilemma, this is very important for anyone who runs a company, runs a family, runs a life. Very often we're presented with dilemmas. We have to be in two places at once. We have to ask ourselves, how can I delegate? Do I need to be here? Or can I have someone else do it for me? Says Reb Schwab, that was the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu said to himself, yes, I need to gather money. Yes, I need to gather Yosef's bones. But let's think about this. What's more befitting? It's more befitting that I myself go and take care of Yosef and allow someone else to take care of the money. The greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu was he knew when to delegate and how to delegate. Very often in life we juggle many responsibilities. We never know what to do ourselves and what to send someone else to do. Says Reb Shuab, that was what Moshe Rabbeinu realized. Chacham Levi, Chachma. He realized, I have two mitzvahs in front of me, but one of those mitzvahs someone else can do. I don't have to do it. Delegate. I'll send my assistant. But some things you got to do yourself. It's a bigger respect to Yosef's bones when you do it yourself. That was the Chacham Lev that Yaakov, that Moshe Rabbeinu taught us in this week's parasha, was in life. I think it's very important in life. We often juggle a million things. Sometimes we got to send other people, we delegate. But you have to realize what's something that should not be delegated and what's something that we should do ourselves.
Yeah.
That's correct. That's the lesson that Moshe Rabbeinu learns again. Man, that's another valuable lesson we'll get to next week's parasha. You have to be able to give over the reins a little bit to other people. Can't do everything yourself. Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, Emes Yaakov, writes that the lesson over here was that Moshe Rabbeinu was very smart. The Medrash tells us that Klal Yisrael only was Zoyche to Kriyas Yamsuf because of Yosef. Because it says in the Pasuk that Yosef was fought the taiva of Eshes Patifar. And for that reason, b'schus that, the Yamsuf split. So if it was Zot Reb Yaakov, Moshe Rabbeinu was very smart. He knew. We got to get through the toll. You got to only get through the toll if you have the bones. So therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu was so preoccupied with getting the bones because he knew that you have to use that to get out of Mitzrayim. We mentioned this in the Sunday morning share. It's worth mentioning again. Reb David Kviat, in the Sefer Sukkahs, David points out, if look at the Lashon HaPasuk. Chacham Lev Yikach Mitzvois. Says Reb David Kviat, in life, we have to balance everything. You have to be able to do two things at once. You have to be able to do the mitzvah of Atzmus Yosef along with the mitzvah of Biza. It's a balancing act. That was the godless. That's a chacham. A chacham is someone who learns how to balance two things. Not pick one over the other. Not delegate, perhaps. But to do both. He was able to balance both these mitzvahs at the same time. Juggling act. That's the greatness. That's the chacham lev of Moshe, was to realize how to juggle. Other Mepharshim point out that the godless of this was that if we were presented with two mitzvahs, one mitzvah involves money, gaining money, and one mitzvah involves not gaining money. So most of us would choose the mitzvah that involves money, because that's the way we're driven. Says the Mepharshim, that was the godless over here. Moshe Rabbeinu went for the mitzvah that doesn't bring him in any money. He could have went to the mitzvah and gathered money. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't care about the money. Farkad, Moshe Rabbeinu lost money on the deal, because since he wasn't busy with the biza, he ended up losing money. So the Arizal writes that a person should try to do mitzvahs in a way that sometimes you'll have to lose a little money. It brings you a chashivas. It's a value. If you give up money for something, that means it's really important to you. They say that the Mat Ephraim, Ephraim Zaver Margolis, whose sefer is widely accepted both in Yom Neroyim time and his sefer on Hilchos Kriyas HaTorah, he was a wealthy banker, an independently wealthy banker. He built his own yeshiva. He was self-supported. So he used to have times when he was not allowed to be disturbed. And he said, it says in the Pasuk, Adam Ki Yomos Po'el. Person is the terrorist compared to someone who dies in a tent. He says, when people need to get a hold of me, tell them I'm dead. That's what he used to tell people. He was learning he was dead. His secretary called him and said, you know, we need to talk to you. I'm dead. That's it. I'm not here. Adam Kiyomis Boyle. And one time he was in the middle of learning and a big business deal came down and he told the people, I'm not available. And they came afterwards, they told him, you should know, you lost a lot of money. He said he was so happy. He said, okay, that's what I have to do to give up for Torah, I'm willing to do that. Because to him, that was the value system. So Moshe Rabbeinu was saying, to me, I'd rather mitzvahs that don't have money. It's not about the money. Moshe Rabbeinu had a very different system, perhaps, than we do, because to him, it was more important to necessarily not to make money, but for him to do mitzvahs was much more important. Okay, so what happens after this? We know that the story doesn't end. The Klal Yisrael travels, and it's important to note this. It's not like they traveled with Derech HaTeva. They traveled with clouds that protected them and guided them. So which means they were already subjective, they already saw Nisim and Nefilos. You know, we always think like, you know, why was Kriyas Yamsuf such a surprise to them? They saw the Makkos. Okay, I agree. But they saw, they had clouds guiding them in travel. So you'd assume to yourself right away that they're not distant in their mind that miracles can happen. They believe in Hashem. Yet, as we see throughout the parasha, they continue to doubt, perhaps, HaKadosh Baruch, which is somewhat interesting to me, because you would assume if they were exposed to it and they saw it and they were privy to see Anani HaKavod, they shouldn't have such a difficult time, perhaps, with believing that HaKadosh Baruch could make anything happen. Rav Moshe Bick writes like that in the Sefer. Rav Moshe Bick writes, when they got to Kriyas Yamsuf, the dilemma in their mind wasn't, will they be saved? It was just a question of how they were going to be saved. They didn't think that they deserved a miracle like Kriyas Yamsuf. Kriyas Yamsuf is a pretty big deal to separate water. That's beyond the normalcy of the world. So they didn't think that would happen. They thought maybe the machine would just all collapse. They'd all faint. They'd all have miracle heart attacks, something like that. They didn't think for a second that what was going to happen was water would split. They didn't think that they deserved such a massive miracle or something like that. What happens? So the pasuk says, "V'amar paro levnei Yisrael." Interesting pasuk. Paro says to the Jewish people, "Nevuchim heim baris." They're lost. Which Jewish people is Paro talking to? "V'amar paro levnei Yisrael." So Rashi says, "No, no." He wasn't talking to the Jewish people. He was talking about the Jewish people. Tagim Yonisim ben Uziel says, no, he was talking to Jews. Who's Jewish left in Mitzrayim? Says the Tagim Yonisim ben Uziel, Dasan v'Aviram. They're still there. Dasan v'Aviram are standing around in Mitzrayim, and Paro talks to them. For Amar Paro, and Paro says to them, ask to Mishul Leib Diskin, they survived Choshech? How could it be? We know Makas Choshech for people like him. Troublemakers, bad people. How did they survive Choshech? 4 out of 4, you know, 80% died. You had to really be up and up. Dasan v'Aviram were no tzaddikim. How did they survive Choshech? Says Yimshul Leib Diskin, who was Dasan v'Aviram? Dasan v'Aviram were the Shaitrim. They were the part of the Mitzrayim's army who were Jews who hit other Jews. But we learned in Parashat Shemois that they were taking the blows for Achenu B'nai Yisrael. The Shaitrim would take the hit for the Jews not producing. Therefore, says Yimshul Leib Diskin, although Dasan v'Aviram had a lot of problems, they had a lot of flaws, but they cared enough for another Jew. If they were taking hits for another Jew, that's a different level of Naisei Ba'olam Chaveri, and that they survived Choshech. They had problems, Dasan v'Aviram, but that was something that they were zeicher to survive. Moshe Sternberg says it's slightly different. Moshe Sternberg says, and we mentioned this on Sunday as well, why did all those Jews die? Why was there such a Holocaust? So because they didn't believe in Moshe Rabbeinu. Dasan v'Aviram believed that it's time to leave. They had their other problems. But as long as they believed that now's the time to go, they're deserving of leaving. So Reb Shteinman asks, one second, if they were around then, how'd they get out later? So Reb Shteinman says they came later, and they joined us, and they survived. They were like in between, you know, they stayed back with Paroi, and then they came later, and therefore they were Zeicha somehow to survive, and that's who the Torah is talking to. So the pasuk tells us, V'chizakti Yisrael Paroi, I made it very difficult for Paroi. And therefore Paroi decided to run after us nonetheless. Pasuk says that Paroi, how did Paroi convince the Mitzrayim? Let's think about this from a Mitzrayim standpoint. Paroi has pride. The Mitzrayim have a little bit of pride, but they're not so, it's not their country. Why would any Mitzrayim follow Paroi? So Rashi says he made it a financial investment. He said, I'm going to share the money with you. Others say, very simply, the Mitzrayim were broke. They lost everything. They had nothing. Their country was broke and they had no money. What's a better option? Stay at home and be broke? They figured, well, it's worth a shot. We'll get some money. We need something. We gave away everything. So therefore, the Mitzrayim were somewhat motivated, perhaps for the wrong reasons, to join Paroi. Pasuk tells us that they joined. And Rashi quotes a very famous chazal that the way the Mitzrayim were was ki'ish. We know Jews are ki'ish echad b'leiv echad. Rashi says the Mitzrayim were ki'leiv echad ki'ish echad. Says Rav Hutner, what's the difference? Says Rav Hutner, because Jews are fundamentally unified because we're all the same. We're all ki'ish echad. Then we're b'leiv echad. Goyim only come together when they share a common hatred. Look at that during the Holocaust, many of the countries that got together just to kill Jews normally would have never spoken to each other. But together, because to share a common hatred, they get together. That's what the goyim, lev echad, kish echad. Their heart is one. They share a certain ideology, a certain feeling, that's what unifies them. There's nothing else intrinsically that unifies goyim except for their hatred or their agenda. So therefore, they always lay first. They have to first come together in their heart, which means they have to share a certain feeling, and then they can be like one. As opposed to Klai, so we're independently, ki ish echad b'lev echad, we're automatically on our own. We are one because we feel, and we are, properly connected of Klai Yisrael, and therefore we are ki ish echad automatically. What happens? So Paroi gets closer. Vayiru moit. Klai Yisrael gets nervous. Vayitzaku b'nei Yisrael al Hashem. And they cry out to Hashem. They don't complain. They cry out. That's what a Jew does when he's in a dilemma. He doesn't complain. Later they complain. They get in trouble. Here they didn't complain. They cried out. Hashem help us. Lashon tefillah. They davened. Kadosh Baruch Hu, you got to come help us. Then the tone changes. That's one group of people. What's the next group? The next group is the group that gives attitude. There's always that group everywhere. Every leader knows it. There's always, right, every Rav, every teacher, there's always a group that gives you the attitude. You know, there's the nice kids that be like, oh, how are we going to survive? Like, you know, you give a test, you have the group that, you know, comes with all, you know, ants, you know, it's very hard on us. Then you have the kids who start complaining. You have no right, right? The kids who give lip, right? We all know those groups. You had to take us here. Says Reb Shteinman, what do you want from Moshe Rabbeinu? He's following orders from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now take it up with the boss. What do you want from me? Says Reb Shteinman, a great yesod. Often in life when we have tainas, our tainas don't make too much sense. That's the beauty of it. It's not logical. We get so upset, we get so frustrated, we start coming with claims and tainas. None of it makes any sense. You want to complain? Blame HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Why are you coming to Moshe? Come to Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is following orders. He's doing what he's told. You don't like it? So go a step higher, right? Everyone knows when you complain on the phone, I want to speak to the supervisor, right? You keep on getting pushed up all the way up to the top. So what do you offer Moshe Rabbeinu? Says Reb Shteinman, it didn't make any sense. Because it didn't make any sense to go to complain either. We don't have enough caves. We don't have enough kvarim. What do you mean by that? So Mepharshim say, what he was saying was, I'd rather die in Mitzrayim and at least be buried. I'll have a matzeva, my kids can come and visit it, the grandkids can come. Here I'm going to be washed in the ocean, no one will ever know I exist. I'd rather go back to Mitzrayim, to the country that oppressed me, and at least have a matzeva. I'll have a resting place. One of the worst things in the world for a deceased body is not to have a matzeva, not to have a kavur, not to have a place. And that's what they were commenting, they were saying is that we want to at least have a place that we can call a resting place for us. And the pasuk continues. So what does Moshe respond to this group? He tells them, don't worry. You'll see what happens. You'll see what Hashem does. Why? Don't worry, you're never going to see a mitzvah again for the rest of your life. Hashem yilochem lochem. Hashem will fight for you. You keep quiet. The Chayodim writes in the introduction to Tefillah Zaka, which we say on Erev Yom Kippur, he says something very powerful. He says that there's four big day kahuna that the Kohen wears. He says we each have four of those. We have our peh, our lashon, our shinayim, and our sefasayim. Our mouth, our lips, tongue, all the things we use to talk. Says the Chayodim, the same way, if one of the begodim of the kohen gets soiled, he can't serve in his capacity as a kohen. If we soil any one of those four things, we also can't daven. Says the Chayodim, that's pshat of the pasuk. Hashem yilochem lochem, v'atem tachrishin, you have to be quiet now, you can't daven anymore. You soiled your mouth with complaining. The moment you started complaining and giving attitude, you soiled your mouth. You soiled it, you can no longer use it for davening. Therefore, says the Chayodim, that's what Tefillah Zaka is all about. We come to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we say, we want to be able to daven to you, but we soiled our mouth. We spoke Lashon Hara, and we spoke the nice, not nice things, and we complained. Therefore, that's Pshat the Pasuk of Atem Tachrishin, now you can't daven anymore. You lost the chance to daven because you soiled your mouth. You soiled it by complaining and having tainas and mouthing off to Moshe Rabbeinu. Once you do that, you can't daven anymore. Now you have to be quiet. Now you have to keep quiet. You no longer have the right to talk because you soiled the ability to daven by talking in such a way. So what happens? So Moshe Rabbeinu, Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu, now is not the time to daven. Why are you davening now? So everyone asks, isn't this what Jews do? We survive on prayer. That's all we have, right? So the Targum Yerushalmi in Ezekiel says, no, Hashem says, I answered your tefillas. You're good. You daven, you titzaku, now let's move on. We daven today, now it's time to move on. I always thought Pshan, the pasuk over here, was a different idea, and I think maybe this is really the lesson of Kriyas Yamsuf. Kriyas Yamsuf was a big deal event. Why was Kriyas Yamsuf so important? Perhaps the greatest of Kriyas Yamsuf was when Klai Yisrael finally had to roll up their sleeves and show and prove their loyalty to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When they were in Mitzrayim and the Makkos took place, this was so easy, it was passive. It was passive belief. They didn't have to do anything. They sat back and watched the Mitzrayim suffer. Great, so I believe in a God who's causing harm to my enemies. Okay, not such a big level. But now I'm going to say, I believe in a God that right now all I see is water and he tells me to go into it. That's a whole different level of emunah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to see Klai, so for this to work, it's got to go two ways. I'm going to show to you and you're going to show back loyalty to me. And that was perhaps the godless of Kriyas Yamsuf. And that's really the whole greatness of Yamsuf. And that's the chashivas of Kriyas Yamsuf. It was the first time Klai saw to roll up their sleeves and show their devotion, their loyalty and their emunah by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And they passed. That's the godless of Kriyas Yamsuf. And that's why now is not the time to daven. Moshe says to Hashem, says, now is not the time. I want to see things. I want to see you. Roll up your sleeves. Make a difference. Get involved. Show me that you believe in me. And therefore, Kadosh Baruch Hu says, now is not the time to daven. So what happens? Very important pasuk over here. Pasuk says that in Perek Yudal, pasuk Chavbeis, when describing it, it says, Vayavo b'nei Yisrael b'sorech hayam b'yabasho, v'amayim lahem choyma mimin am mispoilo. And the water was like a wall on the right and on the left. Many shuls, some people read this pasuk to the niggun that we do for the whole shira. Rabbi Salvechik used to say when he was a kid in his town, they used to sing this pasuk to the niggun. Now there's another pasuk later on, closer to the shira, which is what most of us sing it to the second pasuk. So why in his town would they read it to this pasuk and not this pasuk? Because the next place where the Torah has the word choyma is a little later on. The Torah has the idea of when Klai Yisrael goes to it. So there it says over there, v'amayim lahem choyma, miminom u'mismalam. You'll notice in pasuk chavtes, the word choyma is spelled without a vav. Here the word is with a vav, and there it's without a vav. The Medrash says why? Because you're supposed to read the word choyma is chema, angry. The water was angry. Why is the water angry? So the Medrash says the water was angry because when the Jewish people were walking through the desert, they were carrying their avodah zarah with them. Their pesel micha. Their avodah zarah were with them in their baggage. They had all their bags, right? They had all their snacks. Ever watch a Jewish person go on a trip? They got, you think they're leaving for who knows how long. They packed with snacks for the entire community. They got all their snacks and all their cookies and their cakes and everything. In the middle of there, they have their avodah zarah. So the water was livid. Why am I doing this for you? I'm splitting, which is against my nature, for people that are schlepping avodah zarah. So they said, Rabbi Salvechik, why would you want to sing that song, this pasuk, to the trup of the Shira? So he said, so he used to say when he was younger in his community, they didn't to this pasuk, they did it to the first pasuk. The first pasuk they're saying with the niggin, even though it's before it happens. But here it's an insult to Klai Yisrael. The word is supposed to be read chema, anger. The water is angry. So it's not the right time now to read or to recite it with such a joyous, upbeat tune. The Daz Zakenim on that pasuk points out that the water was livid. The water said, why am I doing this? Why am I going out of my comfort zone for a bunch of people that are being over the dessert? So that the Das Kanim writes that Gavriel came to the defense. And it's an interesting read. He says that Gavriel came and he told the water, listen, he told the water on the right, be careful because Klai Yisrael is going to get the Torah. Torah is on the right, so the wall on the right, stop complaining. What about the wall, the water on the left? Stop complaining because Klai Yisrael is going to get tefillin. That goes on the left hand. So you both, you're right. Right now we have our problems, perhaps. But I think long term, we're going to get out, we're going to get Torah, we're going to get tefillin, even though the mitzvah of tefillin was actually given to us on last week's parasha, we were aware of tefillin, and therefore, don't complain. Then he says, the water in the back, we're going to get talus. So therefore, don't complain about that. He goes through each one of the different things and explains why you should not have a taina, and therefore, Klai Yisrael was zeicha to have Kriyas Yams. The question that many mefarshim ask is, why wasn't the first pasuk missing the vav? If you tell me now that Klai Yisrael went into the yam with their avodah zarah, so shouldn't the first time the Torah has it be mentioned like that? So some people say the first time the pasuk refers to them, they were running for their life. So although they might have had bad cheshbonis, but still, when you're a fugitive and running for your life, you're a little bit more connected to Kadosh Baruch Hu. Now already, this was after the fact. Now they felt like $1 million. Now, oh, we're no longer being oppressed. Oh, now we're going to go back to the avodah zarah. The Kli Yakar has an idea where he thinks there's different groups. There are those who believed and those who didn't believe. The first group were the believers. Those believers, the chaim is with the vav. The second group were the little less believers. They were not fully convinced on Klai Yisrael, and therefore they were a little chaser be'emunah. And because they were chaser in their emunah, that's why the vav is missing and it's supposed to be read anger. Some of them never did. That's why the ego came about, because they still had in them. It was the Mefarshim talked about in last week's parasha. It was very hard for them to get rid of avodah zarah. It was so much part of their nature. It was part of their culture, part of their society. It was very difficult. And this is why we had the ego. And this really went on through Bayis Rishon. Chorban Bayis Rishon was because they couldn't get rid of avodah zarah until Chazal tell us that they took away that taiva for avodah zarah, because it's such a strong taiva. We don't understand it today. To us it sounds so foreign. That's because the Gemara tells us they took it away. If we still have it today, I'm sure the Gemara tells us that we'd all be bowing down left and right. It's just to us it was foreign. So to them it was a very strong and real taiva that they really battled for a long time until good times of the Gemara when it was taken away. Often when we read these parashas, we don't ask ourselves, whatever ended up happening with Paray? What happened to Paray? So I'm very into this because as a quasi-historian, there's much discussion in historian, what ended up happening to Hitler? What ended up happening to Hitler at the end of the whole story, at the end of the Holocaust? So we'll talk first about Paray, then we'll see perhaps there's a connection to what happened to Hitler at the end, and this is really where I run out of material to continue my analysis between Yetzias Mitzrayim, Shiva Mitzrayim, Hitler and Paray, and all of the above. Pasuk says, Lo nishar behem ad echad. There was not remaining up till one. So the Machlokes Rishonim had to read this pasuk. The Daz Zakenim reads this pasuk up to one, but there was one. There was one lone survivor. Who is the one lone survivor? Paray. So writes the Daz Zakenim. So writes the Balaturim. So writes the Medrash. Paray survived all of this. Now, it's pretty amazing that Paray survived all of this. This is all for him. He was the troublemaker. He was the instigator. He was the problem. And yet, through all of this, he survived. That's the way many Rishonim hold. There's a Pirkei of Elazar who says not only did Paro survive, he did tshuva. He became a chayzer b'tshuva. And that itself is a walking lesson to Paro. We have in our mind is, you know, if you have a picture of evil in your head, it's Paro. People are so not willing to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and yet enough pain and oppression, Paro, even Paro. And Mefarshim write, you see from over here, it's never too late for anyone. Everyone can come back, no matter how bad you were, no matter what you did wrong, you can't be worse than Paro. You know, you speak to anyone, all these people that are not connected to religion, no one is as bad as Paro, right? They have a chance to come back. The doors of tshuva are never closed, they're never locked. So therefore, perhaps Paro did do tshuva. That's the opinion of some. There is an Evan Ezra that sounds like to me Paro did not survive. No one survived. That's it. Only the people who stayed in Mitzrayim. Paro, we know when. So the assumption is Paro didn't survive. Now, there's a big discussion whether or not Hitler survived 1945. The reason why it's a discussion is because what happened in 1945 was the Russians beat us to him. The Russians got there before the Americans got there. And by the time the Americans got there, the Russians said, we took care of it already. Hitler is dead and Eva Braun, his wife, is dead. Everyone's dead. Don't worry about it. Let's move on. And they held the records. They had supposedly dental record, jaw record, bone records of both Hitler and Eva Braun. They both killed themselves in his bunker. And that's the way everyone lived a happy life, assuming all evil is over in the world because Hitler is dead. The problem was, as we know today, you can't trust the Russians, right? Speak to our president about it, right? Speak to the media. The Russians were hiding some stuff from us. Not deliberately, but the Russians were doing this because at that time in history, the world was a mess. And everything was a disaster. And the last thing we wanted to be busy with was chasing down Hitler instead of getting the world back together. There's a fellow in Eretz Yisrael in Tel Aviv, a Jewish guy, he wrote a documentary, I don't remember his name, but you can Google it, where he goes through this entire topic well, thoroughly, with details and information. That's where I got a lot of my material from. Where he says that the Americans weren't bad, but the Americans were not interested at this point. There's so many bigger fish to fry, as we say. They had thousands of Jews stuck in these camps without life, and then you had the other part of the world was in disarray. So right now, we'll go with the Russian version. Yeah, Hitler's dead, fine, no one asks questions. As time got better in the 70s, they started to do a little bit more investigative work, and they realized that all the information that they have and all the records was only female records, no male records, which means Eva Braun died, which I don't doubt for a second. The question was, did Hitler die? So, according to many of the historians, Hitler did not die. He survived the war, as we know, and he went to Argentina. He lived in Argentina till somewhere around the 1950s, 1960s, to where he ultimately died at that point, either from Parkinson's or from a strong drug addiction. He was a big addict. He was a drug addict, and he had Parkinson's, and he ended up dying. He didn't live much past the 1950s, 1960s. But I believe this theory, and I'm not a big theory person, but I believe that he did not kill himself. The same reason why I don't believe Paroi. Because there are certain people in the world, when they're convinced they're right, they're never going to go down. Paro was like that. I believe Paro fought till the end because Paro really thought he was right. Paro believed that he was a god, and that's why Paro never, till the end, he thought he was right. Hitler, I think, really believed that he was right, and his method and his ideology was right, and I don't believe he'd kill himself, because if he would have killed himself, he would have done it in 1923. In 1923, when he was arrested for trying to overthrow the German government, he was going to kill himself, and he didn't. Why didn't he? Because he really believed that his mahalach was right. So I don't believe in 1945 he killed himself either. So therefore, I'm somewhat of a believer that he did survive. Which again, there's an irony over here that both him and Paro, who were so evil and so vicious, both somehow came out. To say that Hitler did tshuva at the end, I would not assume so. But Paro presumably did survive, and he was not killed along with the rest of them. But that's really closes the chapter of the similarity that existed between those two very, very evil people in Klal Yisrael's history. As we move on, the Pasuk tells us in Pasuk Lamed that Vayoyisha Hashem Bayemahu Es Yisrael Miyad Mitzrayim. Hashem saved us from the hands of the Egyptians. What does that mean? So the Medrash tells us that Mitzrayim had big tainas on us. You owe us. There was a deal here. You were supposed to work in Mitzrayim for 400 years. You left early. Bounced early. You only left after 210. So that's the Chiddush. Hashem said, no. I saved you from that taina of the Mitzrayim that it was okay for you to leave at the time when you left. Pasuk says, we saw the Jewish people, we saw the Mitzrayim dead along the side of the ocean. Rashi says, why was this so important? Says Rashi, because they don't want the Jews thinking maybe the Mitzrayim also had an undercover tunnel, just like we did. Maybe they had one also. So the Mefarshim points out there's a very important lesson over here. When someone is being oppressed by another person, for the rest of their life, they live with that fear that this person will come back and get them. If the Jews didn't know with a certainty that the Mitzrayim were all dead, they would forever live with this feeling that maybe they're coming and always looking over their shoulder, they would never be able to move on. Hashem Baruch Hu did them a great toiva by enabling them to move on by saying, listen, don't worry, they're gone, they're not here. Look, see, they're not coming back, and therefore you can move on. So there's a story that Tari Tamima says about his uncle and his brother-in-law, the Netziv. The Netziv was once at Amlava Malka in his house, the great Netziv, and someone came to him with the following shaila. Guy made a neder, he's never going to see this guy again. That was the neder he made. They got into a big fight. They're business partners. That's always a school for getting into trouble. He made a neder, I'm never going to see you again. I can't stand you. What happened was the partner died. And now he wanted to go be, somewhat by the Levaya and to ask Mechila and things like that, but I'm not allowed to see him. So they asked the Netziv, is that okay? So the Netziv had a bunch of rabbis at the table. He said, rabbis, what do you think? And the rabbis all said, of course, that's not what he meant by the neder. He meant only Bechayev. So the Tari Tamima, who was his nephew and his brother-in-law, later on married his sister, he said, I don't get all you guys. I have a simple right in this week's parsha. Why? It says in the pasuk before that Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu, tell the Jewish people, you're never going to see the Mitzrayim again. So how are you allowed to see them over here? It says, stira. So that's not called seeing. That's not what we mean. Seeing a dead body is not what it means when you see. So therefore, so the Tari Tamima writes, he said, my uncle was so impressed by this pshat. He was so impressed. He liked it so much. So the Tari Tamima felt like $1 million that he, you know, was mechav into this pshat from his uncle. So they're right. From this week's parasha, that's not really what it means to see something. Seeing means a live person is really what it means to be considered see.
Why would they just be
mechav? Right. I guess that would have been the other option, to be matan eder. Maybe it wasn't possible. Yeah, that was the story he writes about his uncle. Okay. This is all really what I wanted to, what we covered this last time. I wanted to get to the real topic. The Shiva Sayyam. Shira Sayyam, unbelievable. Shira Sayyam. What happened by Shira Sayyam? Klai Yisrael comes up with this unbelievable song and feeling where they describe their love to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they sing Shira. The Rashi tells us that Oz Yashir, quotes the Gemara, it's in the future. Says Rashi, Mikan Rem is Atchias Ames. The Belzer Rebbe of Aaron from Belz, who's just his yard site now, there's a big campaign. They want to raise $5 million in 2 days for the Belz Moistus in Eretz Yisrael. Last I checked, they were 11% there. I don't know where they're holding that. I haven't checked in a while. So Aaron from Belz was the Belzer Rebbe. So the Belzer Rebbe, who is not this Belzer Rebbe, it's this Belzer Rebbe's uncle. That Belzer Rebbe didn't have kids, so it's his uncle. So the Belzer Rebbe survived the Holocaust. How he survived itself is a whole story. And he was sitting with a bunch of people once on the Shabbos, and he was trying to sing Zmiris with them, and they were obviously depressed. They survived, but they lost a lot of family. So the Belzer Rebbe told him, he says, I don't understand. How could Klai Yisrael sing Shira at Kriyas Yom Suf? 4/5 of Klai Yisrael died. Everyone standing around lost someone. How can you sing Shira? How can you express happiness? Says the Belzer Rebbe, that's Pshat Mikan Raya at Kriyas Hameisim. The Kodesh Baruch Hu was telling you, don't worry. Yes, right now you're feeling the pain. But keep in mind, there's going to be a time you're going to be reunited. So the Belzer Rebbe told him that here also. I know right now we're very sad. We lost family members and we can't come to terms of being happy. But it's Shabbos, so we have to remember that we're b'simcha, and connect to that the fact that there's Tchias HaMeisim, that there will be a time when we will eventually reconnect, so to say, with our family. Therefore, says the Belzer Rebbe, that's how, watch why the Torah tells us over here, in the middle of Kriyas Yom Suf, now is specifically the time to relay the message of Tchias HaMeisim, specifically now, while we're at a disappointing feeling, now is the time to think happiness. Right after the men sing Shira, the women sing Shira. Very interesting storyline. The Torah tells us right after that, the Torah says, who else sung Shira? So the pasuk says, Vatikach Miriam hanevi achois Aaron, es hatof biyodah, she took the instrument. Vateitzena kol anoshem achreya betupim u'mecholis. So I saw Reb Shteinman has a whole discussion, what happened to Kol Isha? All these women singing, how's that going to work? So he has a whole discussion, how to get around it. He discussed it. It's an interesting shayla. But the Mefarshim point out, this is the only time there's a woman that the Torah calls her a Neviya, is Miriam. Miriam and Neviya. Why is Miriam a Neviya? The answer is because she's Achois Aaron. The Gemara says in Baba Basra that if someone has an older daughter, the Gemara says it's a Simin. The Gemara's Lashon is an interesting Lashon. The Gemara writes in Baba Basra that a person that has an oldest daughter, it's going to be a Simin Yafa Lebanim. So most people think the Gemara means if you have a first daughter, you can have a bunch of sons afterwards. So pshat like this. If a person has an older daughter who's going to be involved in raising her siblings, a positive role model, simin yafa lebanim means you're going to have good kids. Says the pasuk, vatikach Miriam anaviyah. You know why she was a neviyah? Because she was achos Aaron. She was involved in the raising of Aaron. When you have someone who's involved in the raising of the children, the older sister often gets stuck with a lot of the responsibilities of helping with the younger siblings. But because she was Miriam Hanaviah, the Torah calls her Neviah. It doesn't say Sarah Hanaviah. It doesn't say Rachel Hanaviah. It says Miriam Hanaviah. Why? Because Achlis Aaron, because of the ability that she had to be involved in the raising of a younger brother, Aaron, Moshe not. That's why it doesn't say Moshe, because Moshe wasn't in the Moshe left after a few months. But Aaron, she was very involved with Aaron. She spent time with Aaron. So therefore, Seth the Pasuk, that's why she was so great. But we know, and we quote this many times in the Shurim, that the women had a different level of Amunah than the men did. Why did the men take out any instruments? Because the men didn't really believe as much as the women did. The women believed Be'emunah Shleim that they're going to get out of here. And therefore they had the weapons, they were ready to go. The men didn't. And we know all over Chumash, we talk about this many times, that the level of Emunah that the women had was much stronger than the men. They didn't believe in the big picture, so to say, as much as the men did. And that really connects us to the end of the parasha where we talk about Mara, where Klal Yisrael sees bitter water, and they don't know what to do with the bitter water, and they get to see a bitter stick, and that HaKadosh Baruch Hu shows them his ways in life are not always so understandable. Often in life, we don't understand the ways of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We'll end off with this. I heard an unbelievable story said over from Rabbi Sher, Moshe Sher's sons, said over the story about his father. I didn't know this, that Moshe Sher, at the age of 30, his father-in-law was the Rav of the White Shul in Far Rockaway. I didn't know this. And when Moshe Sher was 30 years old, his father-in-law died. And they were going to give him the Shul, they were going to give him the Rav, he'd be the Rav of the White Shul. And his mother-in-law was very happy. Because this was a big nechama for her. Although her husband passed, at least her son-in-law would still be the Rav. And Moshe Sher was convinced that this was a great job for him. Perfect job, he'd be a Rav and his father-in-law Shul, everything would be perfect. But he told the Shul, I have to first ask my Rebbe, or Baron Cutler, first. He asked the Baron said, absolutely not. I don't want you taking the job. Why? So Baron said to him, we have bigger plans for Moshe Sher than just being the Rav of the White Shul. So he went back to his mother and she was livid. Mamish upset. For 10 years, she was upset at him. She was upset at him for not taking the job. But he followed his Rebbe. One day he gets a call from his mother, his mother-in-law. She says, I want you to come over to the house. I have to show you something. 10 years later. There was an article in the New York Times where Moshe Sher was on the floor of the Senate talking to Congress members, making a big difference. She said, now I understand what Byron said. Yutaka had bigger plans. You weren't just meant to be a small Rav Shul. You had to help Klal Yisrael. Now I understand it. So he was saying, often in life, it's hard to see the darknesses. And you say to yourself, why is the Kosh Baruch Hu doing this to me? Why am I going through all this black and darkness and depression? Sometimes the Kosh Baruch Hu shows us the light at the end. He says, listen, there was a reason for it. It's a lot bigger. You have bigger plans for you. I have a bigger agenda for you. I have more things for you to accomplish. And that's really the lesson of all these parashas, when often we're so bleak and so dark. Kriyas Yam Suf. Klal Yisrael had no idea, well, why are they going through this? The Kosh Baruch Hu says, listen, trust me. I understand what's best for you. I know what's good for you. You have to just believe in me. And that's really the root of a lot of these parashas. And then you get to the end of the parasha with Hamolek. Is this idea of when we're presented with situations where we don't understand the ways of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we have to believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows what's best for us, and ultimately His plan is the best thing that we can anticipate. Okay. Yeah. You're doing well.